appreciation for being asked to be here this morning. I got a call from Brother Soule, and he explained to me that Brother West was burned out and hagged out and flown out and preached out. And I was delighted because I was going to be here this morning anyway. And I appreciate the invitation. I believe with all of my heart, incidentally, thank you for cutting down on the years that I've been preaching. I started in 45. I believe that music is the language of the soul. I believe we can say things in music in a way that we cannot say it any other way. Therefore, I believe that every preacher ought to be a song leader. So I'm a frustrated song leader. I'd like for you to turn to number 694. I believe that for a preacher to be scriptural, he starts his classes with a song. Do we have any of the student preachers here today? Well, I'm going to tell them that during the lectureship. Learn to sing. I really believe that you practice child abuse if you do not teach your children to sing. Because there's certain things in the Lord's worship that depend upon the ability to sing. And if you know something about music and harmony, it is so much richer for everybody. Do you know 694? To Canaan's land I'm on my way, where the soul never dies. My darkest night will turn to day, where the soul never dies. No sad farewell, no tear dimmed eyes, where all is love and the soul never dies. I'm on my way to that fair land where the soul never dies, where there will be no parting hand and the soul never dies. No sad farewells, no tear-dimmed eyes, where all is love and the soul never dies. I didn't see but one person smiling about heaven. 737. Let's smile when we sing. 737. Do you know this one? Do they know all of them? Well, I could have picked some harder ones if people don't usually sing. These are ones I remember from my childhood. I don't ever remember not knowing these songs. Christ our Redeemer died on the cross, died for the sinner, paid all his due. All who receive him need never fear. Yes, he will pass over you. When I see the blood, when I see the blood, when I see the blood, I will pass over you. Where'd this come from? Where'd this come from? The 10th plague, wasn't it? The children of Israel were in bondage, and the 10th plague was going to be the death of the firstborn, and they were told to do what? Kill the best lamb they had, and to make sure they ate all of it or burned what was left, but put the blood where? On the lintel, I believe, the King James Version says, of the door of their homes. And the Lord said, when I see the blood, I'll pass over that house. Now, how many of you ever heard of the death angel? Well, it's not in that story. But most people have been told that a death angel passed over Egypt that night, but I haven't read that in my Bible. Have you, Brother Cooper? Brother West? I haven't. It's the Lord went over Egypt that night. Well, okay, but of course the real strength now of this and the real beauty of it is much later. Verse 4. Oh, what compassion, oh, boundless love. Jesus hath power, Jesus is true. All who obey are safe from the storm. Oh, he will pass over you. When I see the blood, When I see the blood, when I see the blood, I will pass over you. Thank you so very much for singing with me, for exhorting one another, for lifting our hearts in worship and praise to God. Now I want to talk to you today about a chapter in the Bible that you never do read. And I have, what, another hour and a half here? When is this class actually supposed to be over? Do you? I want to be sure and quit on time. I have already been warned by one or two of the elders that I want to be sure and quit on time. But I want to talk to you about a chapter that you and I rarely ever read word for word in the Bible. You know what that is? It may surprise you. It's the first chapter of Matthew. Do you really read that word for word? Do you know all these names? How many of you know all of these names in the genealogy of Jesus? How many of you can say this from memory? Oh, nobody? Well, how many of you know who all these men were? Well, how many of you can spell all these names? Well, how many of you can pronounce all these names? Why in the world is this genealogy in here? Now, let me suggest to you folks that we don't read Matthew 1 word for word. I find myself wanting to skip over it, too, in my daily readings, and I know that you find yourself doing the same thing, but there's some marvelous, marvelous truths in this. There's not a superfluous chapter in the Bible. There's not a superfluous verse in the Bible. Not at all, folks. Every single thing is there because God put it there. And so I'd like for us to look at Matthew 1. I'm reading out of the American Standard Version. The book of the generation of Jesus Christ, son of David, son of Abraham. Abraham begat Isaac. Isaac begat Jacob. Jacob begat Judah and his brethren. Judah begat Perez and Zerah of Tamar. Perez begat Hezron. Hezron begat Ram. Ram begat Amminadab. Amminadab begat Nahshon. Nahshon begat Salmon. Salmon begat Boaz of Rahab. And Boaz begat Obed of Ruth. And Obed begat Jesse. And Jesse begat David the king. Now in the American Standard Version of the printed Bible, you have paragraphs. And they made a paragraph right here in the middle of verse 6. The King James and the New King James doesn't do that, but they made a paragraph. I wonder why. We'll see in a minute. Now go with me to the middle of verse 6. David begat Solomon of her that had been the wife of Uriah. Solomon begat Rehoboam. Rehoboam begat Abijah. Abijah begat Asa. Asa begat Jehoshaphat. Jehoshaphat begat Joram. Joram begat Uzziah. Uzziah begat Jotham. Jotham begat Ahaz. Ahaz begat Hezekiah. Hezekiah begat Manasseh. Manasseh begat Ammon. Ammon begat Josiah. Josiah begat Jeconiah and his brethren at the time of the carrying away to Babylon. And I have another paragraph. A major break in the history of the Jewish people, incidentally. Now verse 12. And after the carrying away to Babylon, Jeconiah begat Shealtiel. Shealtiel begat Zerubbabel. Zerubbabel begat Abiud. Abiud begat Eliakim. Eliakim begat Azor. Azor begat Zadok. Zadok begat Akim. Akim begat Eliud. Eliud begat Eliezer. Eliezer begat Mathan. Mathan begat Jacob. Jacob begat Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus, who is called Christ. So all the generations from Abraham to David are 14 generations. From David to the carrying away to Babylon are 14 generations. And from the carrying away to Babylon unto Christ, 14 generations. Did I pronounce all of them right? Now, Luke has, incidentally, there are 42 generations here. And Luke has a good deal number more, 74 actually, in Luke, the third chapter. And Luke begins with Mary and goes the other way. He goes backwards. But Matthew begins with Abraham and comes down the line to Jesus of Nazareth. Now, they differ. Matthew and Luke differ, but they do not contradict, and there is no mistake. Matthew is a Jew. He's writing to the Jews from the viewpoint of the Jews, and their custom and culture demanded that the legal line would come down through the fathers, the men, just like you and I generally have in the Western world today. And so, though Joseph had nothing to do with the birth of Jesus, yet Matthew is showing by the legal form that he was born into the family of Joseph. Why were they in Bethlehem in the first place? They were there to do what? Satisfy the IRS, weren't they? They were there to enroll for taxes. Why? Well, that was his city, his legal place to go and enroll for the taxes. And that's why they were in Bethlehem. And so Matthew is following the Jewish culture, and he's pointing out that Jesus was born into a family legally known as Joseph's family. But now Luke is different. Luke follows Mary and goes all the way back in the bloodline. Generally, we speak of it as the legal line in Matthew, the bloodline in Luke. They are alike in many places, but several places they separate and are different, but they are not contradictory. Now, there are those who say that this is a contradiction and therefore that the New Testament cannot be written by God because these two genealogies contradict. Well, they just don't know much about biblical culture and history, and or else they would not do that. They also need to realize that there was never a hint of a contradiction or a squabble or a fuss or a denial of these genealogies in the century in which they were printed. That makes a big difference. Because you see, in the first century, when both Matthew and Luke were written, and when they came out and the church had all kinds of enemies, the Jews would have done anything in this world to be able to say, this isn't right, this isn't right, therefore this can't be from God. But there were no squabbles in the first century over this. I think that's a very, very significant thing. And so we need to accept Matthew and Luke just as they are given. But now then, why is this in here? I want to suggest three or four major reasons. Number one is for fulfilled promises of God. God made some very significant promises. And Matthew records some things that show that God did exactly what he said he was going to do. Genesis 12, what did God say to Abraham? Get thee out of thy country, from thy kindred, from thy father's house, unto the land that I will show thee, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and be thou a blessing. Him that blesseth thee will I bless. Him that curseth thee will I curse, and in thee and in thy seed shall all families of the earth be blessed. If you go back to Genesis 12, you'll find that reading, the first few verses. Well, God made a promise that the Messiah was going to be born through the lineage of Abraham. Was he? Well, look at verse 1, the book of the generation of Jesus Christ, son of David, son of Abraham. Verse 2, Abraham begat Isaac. Did God fulfill that promise? Now, he made it several times to Abraham. He made it to Isaac. He made it to Jacob. Going right down the line, Abraham, of course, had a son previously because of his lack of good judgment, I guess you might say, or impatience. He and Sarah were impatient, and Hagar was given to him, and Ishmael was born. And Ishmael was already a teenager, and God came back to Abraham and told him again, you're going to have a son, you and Sarah. And Abraham said, oh, that Ishmael might live before thee. Well, Abraham thought he'd helped God. Yes, he thought he helped him, and here was the son that God had promised. But God said, no, that's not it. You're going to have a son born of Sarah. And so, of course, Isaac was born. And then Isaac had the sons, Jacob and Esau. And Jacob had 12 sons by four women. You know the story, I'm sure, of how his deception of his father to get the blessing and the birthright was sort of paid back to him by his future father-in-law, Laban, because when he went to marry Rachel, he got Leah. And he had to work 14 years altogether to be able to marry Leah and Rachel. And, of course, Leah had Reuben and Simeon and Levi and Judah. And interestingly enough, Leah was called the unloved because Jacob always seemed to favor Rachel. You know, when he went back to meet Esau, who did he put in the front lines up there in case Esau came with an army? Why, he put Leah and her bunch up there, and he kept Rachel back with him. Well, there's several things that showed the favoritism and special love that he had, but look how God blessed Leah. Are you aware that every time an animal was ever offered by the Jews up until the time that Jesus died on the cross, that a son of Leah did it? Leah was the mother of the priestly man, the tribe of Levi. You ever think about that? And then Leah was also the mother of the one through whom the Lord came, Judah. Now, God said, the scepter shall not depart from Judah until Shiloh come, Genesis 49:10. And that means Shiloh is one of the Old Testament words for the Messiah. So God made a solemn promise that through Abraham and his lineage coming all the way down. But now Jacob had 12 sons. They couldn't all come through all of them, could they? Jesus couldn't come through all of them. And we understand that he came through Judah. How many of you know the 12 sons of Jacob by memory? I see one hand. Did y'all ever go to Sunday school? You didn't have to do drills like that? Why, Peter, Andrew, James, and John, Philip, Bartholomew, Thomas, Matthew, James, Thaddeus, Simon, and Judas. Is that right? How do you know it's not right? Oh, okay. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Dan, Gad, Naphtali, Asher, Issachar, Zebulun, Joseph, and baby boy, Benjamin. Exactly. But only one of these could be the one through whom Messiah was to come, and that was Judah. And so we find that here the promise was made to Judah, and there's Judah. Well, here's one of the great promises that's been fulfilled. Now, the second great promise to be fulfilled was to David. God made a promise in 2 Samuel 7 that David would be the one through whom the Messiah was to come. And 1 Chronicles 17 puts it on a basis that says, from among thy sons shall one arise to sit upon that throne. And so there was a great promise made to David that his lineage would be the one that the great Messiah, the anointed king, was going to come. Well, did he come through David? He came not only through David, but in such a powerful way that he's mentioned first. Look at verse 1. The generation of Jesus Christ, son of David. And what did Peter preach on Pentecost Day? He said, why, the tomb of David is with you till this day. Yet David spoke many things about this great one that has come, but David was a very, very prominent person in Jewish history. And God made a promise that David's lineage would be the one where the Messiah would come and sit upon his throne. Well, Matthew 1 records that Jesse begat David the king, and David begat Solomon of her that had been the wife of Uriah. Verse 6. Now, are you aware that no one today among the Jews can claim a certain tribe? Are you aware that the genealogical records of the Jews were destroyed in A.D. 70 when Jerusalem was destroyed? And that they were never able, being scattered all over the world, never able to keep genealogical records until just this last century? Interesting to me that God kept them together long enough to accomplish his purposes. Like Galatians 4 says, when the fullness of time came, God sent forth his son, born of a woman, born under the law. One of the fullnesses of time, I believe, was the fact that the Jews kept very specific genealogical records up until the time that Jesus came, and therefore this genealogy can be there and be accurate. But after A.D. 70, when the Jews were scattered so far and so broad, they were not able to keep those genealogies for 1,000 to 15, maybe 1,700 years. Interesting, isn't it? Very interesting. No Jew today can actually know of what tribe he is. If Jesus has not come, as the Orthodox Jews say, then how would you know that he was Jesus? Because you would not know whether or not he came from the tribe of Judah. No way. Please understand that. But now thirdly, the third promise. And that is, he made a promise to Jesus would be born of a virgin. Start with me now in verse 18. On the birth of Jesus Christ was on this wise, when his mother Mary had been betrothed to Joseph, before they came together, she was found with child of the Holy Spirit. And Joseph, her husband, being a righteous man, not willing to make her a public example, was minded to put her away privately. But when he thought on these things, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream, saying, Joseph, son of David, fear not to take unto thee Mary thy wife, for that which is conceived in her is of the Holy Spirit. And she shall bring forth a son, and thou shalt call his name Jesus, for it is he that shall save his people from their sins. Now all this came to pass that it might be fulfilled that was spoken by the Lord through the prophet, saying, behold, the virgin shall be with child, and shall bring forth a son, and they shall call his name Emmanuel, which is being interpreted, God with us. Joseph arose from his sleep, and did as the angel of the Lord commanded him, took unto him his wife, knew her not till she had brought forth a son, and he called his name Jesus. Thirdly, God had made a promise that Jesus would be born of a virgin. This is a quotation in verse 23 from Isaiah 7, verse 14. Now, whatever that meant to King Ahaz back yonder is not really what I'm concerned about today. That's an interesting study all its own. But I'm interested today in understanding that we have an inspired commentary on what God wanted it to mean to us. You know what an inspired commentary is? It's when an inspired New Testament writer goes back and picks up something out of the Old Testament, brings it over and says, folks, this is it. You know, like Peter did, this is that which was given by the prophet Joel, Acts 2. Now Matthew comes along and says, here it is, folks. God made this promise 750 some odd years ago that he would be born of a virgin, and here it has happened. That's an inspired commentary on Isaiah 7 and verse 14. But now then, I want you to notice how carefully Matthew protects this beautiful young lady. He is very, very careful that it be known that she was virtuous, that she was chaste, that she was a virgin. First of all, how many times does he use the word beget? Abraham beget Isaac. Isaac beget Jacob. Jacob beget Judah and his brethren. Beget, 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 beget. Did you notice? Did you ever count them? There's 39 of them. Yet it stops down in verse 16. I wonder why. And Jacob beget Joseph, the husband of Mary, who beget Jesus. That's not the way the Bible reads, ladies and gentlemen. He has used it 39 times between men and their sons. And now between Joseph and a son, he does not use it. He leaves out beget. I wonder why. He wants the world to know that Joseph was not the father. But I want you to notice something else in verse 16. Jacob beget Joseph, the husband of Mary, of whom was born Jesus. Of whom is a prepositional phrase. Relative pronoun is the object of the preposition, the word of. Whom is the pronoun. Now, what is the law of the antecedent of the pronoun? Any of you remember that? I was just talking to Brother John Hamilton, and he and I were reminiscing about dear old Brother W. Claude Hall, our English teacher at Freed Hardeman College, back when he was, incidentally, he was in school with my father, not me. I want you to understand that. But, anybody remember the law of the antecedent of the pronoun? Anybody here ever take English? Anybody here ever teach English? Surely we have an English teacher here. I'm not going to call on you to do it, but dear old Miss Green in my fourth and fifth grades, I can remember her making us go to the board and diagram sentences. Oh, how we hated Miss Green. Oh, she'd make us get up there and diagram these sentences. You know, subject and predicate and prepositional phrases and clauses and all of these other things. And we had to, any of you all remember diagramming? But I rise up now and call her blessing, because she made us learn some things that are very, very valuable in communication. And here we have a prepositional phrase, of whom. Whom is a relative pronoun and has an antecedent. The law of the antecedent is that there is a word previous in the sentence to which that pronoun can refer, the nearest. Either a proper name, a noun, or another pronoun. So we look previously in that sentence, of whom, and the first one we come to is a proper name, Mary. So Matthew is very, very consistent here. But then furthermore, this word whom is in the original Greek a feminine pronoun. Now you and I don't have masculine and feminine in the English language, but they do in the Greek. And this is the feminine word, hais. And it can only refer to something that is feminine. It literally could be translated, Jacob beget Joseph, the husband of Mary, of her was born Jesus. If you wanted to translate it with the word her, it would be perfectly accurate and proper according to the Greek language. But then there's another thing there. Who's the only one there that can give birth? Jacob can't give birth. Joseph can't give birth, but somebody gave birth. Now, who was it? Well, it was Mary. And so he's very, very careful to protect her. But now I want you to notice, over there in verse 23, behold, the virgin shall be with child. That word virgin is the Greek word parthenos. And it can only refer to a young lady who has had no sexual experience whatever. Now, the word Alma is used in the Hebrew in the Old Testament in Isaiah 7, 14, from whence this is quoted. And there's a great deal of controversy over the definition of the word Alma in the Old Testament. Well, that doesn't really make too much difference to me at this point, because I know what Matthew is saying. He is saying that there was a young, virginal, chaste woman who gave birth to Jesus because of a miracle of the Holy Spirit. But there's another law of the Greek that you may not be familiar with, and that is the law of the definite article. This says the virgin, not just a virgin. But when you put the definite article, T-H-E, in front of something in the Greek language, it means something very special. The law of the definite article is an important part of the Greek language. And Matthew says this is the virgin. It's like saying, this is the one and only virgin that this will ever happen to. That's how powerful that law of the definite article is. But then I want you to notice something else. When God appeared to Joseph in the dream, verse 20, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream and said, verse 21, she shall bring forth a son, and thou shalt call his name Jesus. Now, an angel named Gabriel had previously, a few months, gone over to visit with Elizabeth and Zacharias concerning the birth of whom? John the Immerser, John the Baptist. And if you go, I think it's verse 13 in Luke 1, the angel said, she shall bear thee a son, speaking to Zacharias. Whoa, she shall bear thee a son? But now we come over here to an angel coming to Joseph and saying, she shall bring forth a son. You see any difference in those two? Very much difference. Because the angel Gabriel is saying, Zacharias, you're going to be the father. She shall bear thee a son. But the angel that appeared to Joseph in that dream is saying, you're not the father. This is of the Holy Spirit. She shall bring forth a son, but it will not be yours, is the force of that. To one man he said, it's going to be your son. To the other man an angel said, it is not your son, but this is of God. Oh, it just goes on and on and on how tenderly Matthew is protecting this young lady. Well, that's point number one, fulfill promises. Point number one, I gave you three examples. Promise to Abraham, promise to David, and a promise to the virgin. God fulfills his promises. Now, point number two is women. This is something that is never done. You can't find this in another genealogy of the Jews to save your neck, as we say down in Florida. You couldn't find it if you wanted to. Why? Because the women were a subculture in that particular time. They could be bought and sold on the slave market. They could be one of several wives. They were simply the property of the man. The culture of the Old Testament was such, and even of Jesus' time, the culture was such that women were demeaned. Not at all like God intended for it to be done, be at creation. But nonetheless, that's what the culture of the world had done. Do you remember that Hosea was told to go and buy his wife back on the slave market as a prostitute? Do you remember the multiple wives of many of the men of the Old Testament? And the problems that came along with polygamy? Polygamy is very demeaning. Do you also remember that there is no provision in the old law of Moses for a woman to put away her husband? Are you aware of that? There was no way a woman could put away a man. But Deuteronomy 24 says that if a man finds in her some unseemly thing, that he can put her away and give her a writing or a bill of divorcement. Well, what is an unseemly thing? Oh, that's a great argument. If you want to get started what an unseemly thing is in Old Testament days, it can go from everything from adultery down to burning the biscuits for breakfast. And he could put her away. Give her a bill of divorcement and send her packing. But a woman couldn't divorce her husband. Now, that wouldn't happen today. That couldn't happen today. Do you know why? Because women don't cook biscuits anymore for breakfast. So you men couldn't put your wife away for burning biscuits for breakfast. How many of you men had hot biscuit for breakfast? Two? Look at there. Well, now, were they whopping biscuits or were they real biscuits? You know what a whopping biscuit is? You take it out of the freezer and whop it on the edge of the drain board and put them out. I'm talking about scratch biscuits. I was over in Pennsylvania in State College several years ago, and I made this illustration, and the little girl that was majoring in agriculture over there in Penn State University came up to me after, and she said, Brother Lanier, do people in the South really make biscuits out of chicken feed? Because I use the word scratch. Well, scratch biscuits to us Southerners means you take all the ingredients and put them together. You don't take them out of a can. But you see, women don't cook biscuits today, so you can't put them away for burning the biscuits for breakfast. Now, I'm a long way from being a good marriage counselor. But if any couples have come to me through the years, you know what I've asked them? I've asked them, number one, sir, are you waked up every morning with the smell of hot biscuit and cream gravy? And usually he'd say no. And then I'd ask her, ma'am, are you involved every so often, maybe several times a month, in getting some beautiful flowers from your husband? And she'd usually say no. I'd say, well, there's your problem. You start giving flowers and cooking biscuits and you couldn't get rid of each other. Now, the man may die early of a heart attack from eating so many biscuits and gravy. The idea, folks, is simply thoughtfulness and unselfishness and love projected in things. I don't see a thing in the world pretty about flowers, but I guarantee you, men, if you'll stop on the roadside and you pick three or four little old blossoms and you bring them in from work and you say, honey, I saw these and I was thinking about you, she'll melt. Now, that wouldn't mean much to a man, but for some reason, flowers evidently are given by God to really touch the heart of women. And I guarantee you, good hot biscuits and cream gravy will touch the heart of a man. But you see, the divorce in Old Testament days was only for the man. And here we have women involved in a genealogy. Now that's the point. Something that's absolutely unheard of. Did you pick out the five women that are mentioned in this genealogy? Matthew does something nobody else ever does. Mary has to be there, of course, in verse 16. Well, who are the other women? Well, you go back to verse 6 and you'll find her that had been the wife of Uriah. Do you know her name? Bathsheba. Was Matthew too embarrassed about that incident to even put her name in there? Then you go back up a little bit and you find in verse 5 another one, don't you? Ruth and Rahab. And if you go back to verse 3, you find yet another, and that is Tamar. Ladies and gentlemen, I want you to know something, that Matthew is doing something here that was never, never done. Why is this in the genealogy of Jesus Christ? I'm not sure I know, but I would suggest that my thinking and study leads me to the idea that Jesus brought women back up to the place where they were created. Culture had demeaned them, had put them down under the foot of men, had made them little more than possessions and property. That's what the world had done, but Jesus Christ came and pointed out that women are back up to the glory and the beauty for which they were originally created. I want to suggest to you that might be why women are mentioned in the genealogy of Jesus. I'm not sure that's true. That's just simply my opinion, but it's certainly an unusual thing. Ladies, I would say something to you, that you have certain beauties and virtues and glories and courtesies and manners and all of those many marvelous feminine things, that you're up yonder on the pedestal. Yes, you're above us men in many ways. You have so many virtues of soul and spirit that men will never know. Due to your femininity, God made you feminine. God made we men masculine, and we're different. We're not just different physically, but we're different in many other ways. And so many churches through the years that I have preached have been held together by many of the godly women who provide the strength and quiet beauty of soul to lead people to Christ and to keep them faithful in the Lord. Ladies, please don't come down off of that beautiful pedestal up there and try to compete with men. Don't try to dress like men and talk like men and act like men. We need your gracious beauty and femininity in our homes and in the church and in our schools and in our nation. Jesus brought women back up to where he created them in the first place. Well, the third thing I suggest to you in this genealogy is not only fulfilled promise, three examples, but also the idea of women. But thirdly, I would suggest Gentile. Are you aware that some Gentiles are mentioned in this Jewish genealogy? Can you imagine what this might have done to those who were purists of race among the Hebrews? Can you imagine how they despised one another? The Jews and the Gentiles despised each other. And are you aware that Jesus at the well in John 4, he broke every tradition there was. He spoke to a Samaritan woman. She was of mixed blood, Jew and Gentile, a Samaritan, a result of the split between Jeroboam and Rehoboam back after the death of Solomon. And here he is not only speaking to a woman in public, well, speaking to a woman, period, speaking to a woman in public, secondly, and asking her questions, but a Jew asking a Gentile something. And that's what she immediately was surprised to find out. How come you being a Jew are asking me this? The hatred between Jew and Gentile was so intense in those days that you and I cannot even begin to imagine it. We have never had racial hatred in America, even during the days of slavery, civil war, and thereafter. Never has it been as intense as between Jew and Gentile in the days of Jesus Christ. And yet here are Gentiles mentioned in the genealogy. After all, who was Ruth? Moabite. She was a Moabitess. Now, she did convert. There's no doubt about that. She became a Jewish proselyte. But who was Rahab? Canaanitess in Jericho. Now, she converted and became a Jewish proselyte, but nonetheless, by blood, you're talking about two Gentile women. And then there's a possibility even of Bathsheba being of Gentile blood. Well, why in the world is this mentioned in the genealogy of Jesus? I suggest to you that it may be for the same reason that women were mentioned. That Jesus came to heal that conflict and to lift them up together as equal and as brothers together in creation. That there is no difference between Jew and Gentile. And this is, of course, some of the major preaching of Paul and Peter in their epistles and also in their speeches and in their preaching. That God is made of one blood, every nation of men to dwell on the earth. And yet here Matthew is in this genealogy including Gentiles. I think that is very, very significant. So we have women mentioned, we have Gentiles mentioned, and now the fourth point is we have sinners. Grievous, heinous sinners mentioned. Did you know that nearly every one of the kings after David, every other one was usually a bad king? For some reason, it seemed like that good kings had bad sons and bad kings had good sons. And so as you go down that line, of course, Jesus had royal blood flowing in his veins because he came from the kings of David's descent. But you find terrible, heinous stories in that bloodline. Let's just take one or two there that deal with the women because they're mentioned. Her that had been the wife of Uriah. Verse 6. You remember the story of David stealing another man's wife, causing him to become drunk, trying to deceive him about a pregnancy and about his illicit adulterous union with this man's wife, and finally causing him to be killed in battle. Now, David was, of course, sorrowful and penitent about that, and you can't read the Psalms of what you read how penitent he was. And he was a man after God's own heart. But this is a terrible, sinful thing. And that may be the reason that Matthew did not even mention her name. It was said by the Jewish rabbis of the first century that her name was not even to be spoken. And that may be why Matthew, by inspiration, left out the name Bathsheba. But there's another case there. Of course, Rahab was a harlot in Jericho until she converted to the Lord in the law. Many try to say that that word harlot in the Old Testament just referred to a woman who had an inn and she just kept sort of like a motel. But the preponderance of evidence seems to be that she was a sinful woman. She was illicitly, sexually sinful. Doesn't make any difference whether she was or not, because when she repented and turned to God and began to serve him, her sins were forgiven and she could be saved. But why mention that? How come Matthew doesn't mention Sarah? How come he doesn't mention Leah? How come he doesn't mention Rebecca? Many of the worthy, wonderful women of the Old Testament. Why mention these women? And probably one of the ugliest stories of all is in verse 3. Judah begat Perez and Zerah of Tamar. Tamar was not his wife. Tamar was his daughter-in-law. This is incest. This is adultery, fornication of the rawest kind. You see, there was a Levirate law of marriage in those days that said that if a man died before a son was born that could continue his bloodline, that a near kinsman was to take his wife, and the first son that was to be born would be a son that would continue the bloodline of the dead first husband. This had a lot to do with the way that the land was taken care of in those days, inheritance and all of these things, but nonetheless, that was the practice. You remember that's true because that's how Ruth and Boaz got together. He was a near kinsman, and her husband had died before there were children born. Well, Tamar married Judah's son. He died before a son was born. She went to Judah and asked that she be given to a near kinsman, and he said, I don't have anybody right now. There's a younger son, too young to marry. When he grows up, you can become his wife. So she waited evidently patiently for years. But the Bible says in Genesis 38 that she took off her widow's garments and put on the clothing of a prostitute and sat by the roadside and enticed her father-in-law to come into her, and she became pregnant by him. That's a horrible story. That's a horrible story, but it's what happened, and it's in the bloodline of Jesus Christ. I wonder why Matthew is mentioning so much about sinners. Well, above all, Jesus came to seek and save that which was lost. So I want you to remember Genesis, or rather the genealogy of Jesus in Matthew 1 because of fulfilled promises. Promised to Abraham, promised to David, and promised to a virgin. I want you to remember the unusual use of women. I want you to remember the unusual mention of Gentiles. And I want you to remember the unusual use of sinful people. Because Jesus came to cure it all. That was the bell. Thank you.
Not this fellowship.